This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Donald Trump proposes an overhaul of the food stamp program, and everybody has a different opinion on it. We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. I'm Caleb Cockwood. Welcome into Tactics. Do apologize for the slight delay there. There was a bit of a technical error. My headphones were not working properly. They weren't where they were supposed to be. So my intro played, my music played, but I couldn't hear any of it, and so I thought there was an error. And here we are today. So a rocky start to this Friday, but nothing that cannot be overcome. It feels like Friday. I've got a little Friday-itis, and I got to tell you, the weather outside, it's funny, I was talking about how windy and cold and rainy and nasty it was earlier this week, and now it feels like, about mid to late April, so that's weather in Alabama for you. It cannot make up its mind. But welcome in. It's great to be with each and every one of you this morning. It's great to be with you on this Friday. The SNAP program, which, for those of you who are unaware, that's what used to be referred to as the food stamp program. It really hasn't changed that much. It's just the name. But the SNAP program, there is a proposal by the Trump administration to completely overhaul the SNAP program. So here's the long and short of it. It's a little more involved than this, but this gives you a pretty good idea in summary of what the proposal would do. So in this proposal by the Trump administration in the new budget, they are suggesting that anybody who receives more than $90 in SNAP benefits per month, they will get at least half of their benefits in food packages known as harvest boxes. So instead of getting just the EBT card, or like they did in the old days, the paper food stamps, what they will be getting is that they'll still get those, but they'll get about half the money that they're used to getting. And the other side of that is they're going to get the rest of their benefit in these harvest boxes. So there's a couple things here. It would contain shelf-stable milk, pasta, cereal, beans, peanut butter, canned vegetables, things of that nature. You know, not fresh vegetables, not fresh fruits, not meat that would have to be refrigerated, or anything that would need refrigeration, because obviously that's more hassle and it could spoil. And that kind of stuff is better for you to pick up locally if you can anyway. So it will primarily be stuff that you could ship that wouldn't be refrigerated, that has preservatives in it. And so that will be how you receive your benefits. And it's interesting that this is coming on the heels of really a revolution when it comes to grocery shopping anyway. I think that this would have seemed much more foreign to people of past generations than it will to people now, because Amazon and other companies are trying out grocery services. Now, in our area, this isn't something that's widely known or popular because we don't necessarily have the infrastructure to support it, but in some cities like Dallas, for example, there's Amazon Fresh, where they have a distribution center right there. Amazon has a lot of infrastructure in that city. And so you can order your groceries online just like you would shop for anything else on Amazon, and it pops up on your doorstep. And there are other services that actually are here that are getting closer and closer to that. For example, you have Walmart Grocery, where you do all your shopping online. You tell them when you're going to come by and pick it up, and you pay online. And then you just pull up to Walmart, the people come out, give you your groceries, and you go off on your merry way. Used it a few times. I like the service. You know, there's some pros and cons to doing it one way, or doing it the traditional way. But my point is, the way we receive food and gather food is changing. And it's interesting that this proposal for the SNAP program is coming at a time where people are starting to rethink how they get food to their family. So this could go a long way on cutting down on abuse, because you're not getting EBT cards with money on them, you're getting actual food. And it's a lot harder to do something underhanded to get something other than food when food is showing up at your door. So this could go a long way to curb abuse. A great story to kind of give an example. Now, this is an extreme case, of course, but there was a case in Oregon of food stamp fraud where the guy was buying people's food stamps, the grocer was, and then giving them back about half the money. So the way he was doing it is he was taking their EBT but giving them cash that they could spend on anything in return. And it turns out that in this case, he is accused of stealing over $189,000 through EBT cards. And this is one thing that could curb a lot of other abuse. I know that there is a lot of abuse that goes on. I was actually talking with my dad about this story, and he was talking about something that he saw. He calibrates gas pumps. He's probably talked about that when he's filled in and hosted for me while I was out with my cancer treatments. But I believe that the way he told the story is that he was in one of the gas stations and he had one of the guys go in there and buy several gallons of milk with an EBT card. And what he did was loaded up the milk, turned around, and sold it at his own store. He overheard him talking to the cashier there at the gas station. And so he's buying milk with his EBT card to sell at the grocery store that he owns. Well, that's another form of abuse, because whatever he was charging for that milk at his store, that was 100% profit. I mean, not for us. The taxpayers still had to pay for it. But for him, he wasn't paying anything for the milk, and he was getting money out of it. That's another form of food stamp abuse. Another example of just someone who didn't need it. And I think just about all of us have a story like this. This was something that happened not too long ago to a buddy of mine. You may remember him. He was actually one of my guests in the Nerd Herd. It's Andrew, somebody that I've been friends with for a long time. And he said one of the most infuriating things that he had ever seen. And keep in mind, this is Andrew, so he does tend to exaggerate things a little bit, but the details of the story are true, because there was somebody else with him that confirmed all this. You know, he gets mad about things easy, but this was 100% true. What happened is he was behind the line in the grocery store with someone who was using an EBT card, and when he went outside, he noticed that they were in the car next to him. So they bought a thing full of groceries with an EBT card, and he also noticed that while they were standing in line waiting to get checked out, they had a brand new iPhone, much, much nicer than his. And when they went out to their cars, his car was either the next one or the one one car down. And, you know, Andrew gets into his 3.5-year-old truck that's in about barely better shape than mine. And this guy, who is just bought a couple $100 worth of groceries and food stamps, gets into a brand new blue Mustang. Brand spanking new model, everything shiny, looked great. And so he's like, this guy has a better phone than me and a much nicer car than me, and somehow he's getting government assistance. I've got a wife and a kid and two dogs to feed and two foster kids, and they're not helping me any. And a lot of us have stories like that, and it does get frustrating. I realize that not everybody on food stamps does that. Who knows? It may not even be the majority of people. But the truth is, after study after study after study has shown that abuse and misuse of food stamps is a pretty common occurrence. And this would go a long way in curbing that. The United States Department of Agriculture actually estimates not only could this plan cut down on food, but according to their numbers, they're saying that it would save about $129 billion over the next 10 years on the food stamp program. Now, $129 billion, that's a lot over 10 years. Is it perfect? No. Is it going to fix every problem with the food stamp program? Absolutely not. However, being able to put that forward and save that much money and cut down on fraud, I mean, it seems like on all fronts, this is a good idea to reform the SNAP program. People on SNAP, by the way, had increased quite a bit under the Obama administration. There had been 33.5 million the day he took office. The statistics show that when he left office, about 2 or 3 months before he left office, because that was the last statistic that was available, there were 44.2 million. So that's an increase of quite a bit. In fact, that's about a 33% increase of the SNAP program. And since Trump has taken office, now, again, correlation doesn't show cause, but the way that the economy has started roaring back to life, I do think that that has played a role in it. Now, whether you give Trump all the credit for that, partial credit for that, regardless, there are 1.5 million of those 44.2 million people that are now off food stamps. So now, instead of seeing an increase in people receiving means-tested government assistance, we're actually doing the opposite. People are starting to get off of government assistance, which is something that should be applauded by everybody, Republican and Democrat. And under Obama, the cost rose from about $50.3 billion to $66.6 billion, which makes sense. You've got more people on the program. Obviously, it costs more money. But cost is something that definitely needs to be looked at, and saving this amount of money over the next 10 years would really go a long way to help that. And we're going to go to this because a lot of people are saying this is unchristian, this is cruel, which I don't understand that mentality anyway, but we're going to go over that and go over some of the concepts and precepts underneath this proposal when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Christian religion is above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times. The religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. John Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. Either one of those options work for us. So if you're at your desk, you can't call in right now, just shoot me a tweet. I will try to get to those, read those on the air if I get a chance. Actually, what we've been talking about with the SNAP program, it's funny to me because this policy that Donald Trump is putting forward about getting at least half of the benefits for most of the people who receive any of the SNAP benefits, giving it to them in food as opposed to giving it to them in just cash that they can go spend it on whatever they want. It's, you know, more open to abuse, that kind of thing. It actually reflects my policy when it comes to giving to the poor and panhandlers. So what I deal with, because I work in downtown Montgomery, I've run into several panhandlers since then, whether I'm walking or, you know, going somewhere. And sometimes, occasionally, just like everybody else, panhandlers walk up to you and ask you for money, tell you that they're hungry, that kind of thing. I never give them money, but I always help them because there's restaurants nearby. I offer to go out and take them for lunch. And so I don't ever give panhandlers money because I understand that it can be misused, used for things that they don't need, you know, cigarettes or whatever else it may be that they want. But I still do want to help them out. And I think the happy medium there is to give them something that they can't abuse or use for the wrong reasons. Because let's just say they're lying to me and they have plenty of money. Well, that means that I've just bought lunch for somebody, which it may not have been if they were being dishonest with me. Maybe that's something that I could have used or put to better use helping out somebody else. But the point is, at that point, the absolute worst case possible scenario is that all I have done is feed somebody. I can live with that. I don't have a problem with that. And so giving somebody a item that they cannot abuse helps limit that they can't misuse it or use it for something that it was not intended. And it actually reminds me very closely of something my church at Auburn did with food distributions. What we used to do, and I used to go out Thursday mornings and help them with this, they had a day set aside where everybody in the community knew it, and there were a couple of church members that came to this, but we usually had about 40 people there in the Opelika area. And the vast majority of the people that came to get food were not members of the church. So everybody in the community that needed this knew about it. and they could come by. They got on our registry, and we would have a pre-made box of food ready for them. And it changed every time we did it. So sometimes it would have stuff, actually mostly stuff like the harvest box that Donald Trump is proposing would have. Things like canned vegetables, beans, pasta, powdered milk, if that's what we had around at the time. And the vast majority of those things were donated by the members of the church. And what I mean by that is not things that the church went out and purchased at a grocery store. We just put the items up on the screen before worship, and we would have people bring those items in for that month, and then we would have food distributions every week. So this is actually really similar to something that my church has done. Dalrata did something similar one time. We gave out a bunch of basically the stuff to make lasagna minus the meat itself. So all the ingredients that you would need for something like that. And so this is, I think, a really good idea, something that could be incredibly beneficial to people. Furthermore, this has caused quite a bit of controversy, though. And it is ironic that people are upset that Donald Trump is, quote unquote, not caring for the poor and hungry by giving them food. That seems a little counterintuitive, but this is really one of the arguments that are being made, that Donald Trump is against the poor and he doesn't like poor people and he's against helping them despite the fact that his proposal is to bring them food. And I don't really understand logically how you get to that point, but that is what people are oddly enough accusing him of at this point. And so if you're looking at this proposal and what it would actually do, with it saving money, with it cutting down on abuse, because that's what we always hear from the left, is that we don't want people to abuse this stuff. We just want it to be for people that need to get back on their feet and not be dependent upon it. Well, this is a great way to do that. And keep in mind that this is not a small ticket item. The USDA, the vast majority, I believe if it's not 80%, it's very close to 80% of their yearly budget. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, almost 80% of their budget, if not over 80% by this point, goes to the SNAP program. So considering how much taxpayer dollars we spend on this, cutting down on fraud and abuse would go a long way in restoring faith in that program. Now, I don't agree with the program. I'm a libertarian. Y'all know where I stand on that, and we'll get to that in just a second. And some of the excuses that liberals are making of why this is a bad idea. We'll break those down in just a moment. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers, and you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio, which, by the way, right before we dive back into our subject matter, which we will do momentarily, I did want to mention that the podcast that we're doing, where we're doing just one segment as opposed to doing the whole show, those are going incredibly well. We have upped our listenership, our viewership on those much more than the full show podcast. So I think we've gotten about 70 or so just in the past few days since we've been doing it. So that's maybe 3 or 4 days worth and getting 70 listeners, which is way up. So be sure to check those out. They're really cool. They're just one-off little segments. So if you don't have time to listen to an hour and 20-minute show, totally understand that. That's why we're doing this, to help you out. We don't have them on the website quite yet, but if you do want to listen to them and hear what they sound like, they are on the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/tacticsradio, and you can check them out on Twitter at Tactics Radio as well. So be sure to look at those. We're doing them in a new format now, so if it's been a while since you've listened to one of my podcasts, we're doing them completely differently. Be sure to check those out. Of course, if you do want to listen to the full episode, you are more than welcome to do so. We still have those up at www.tacticsradio.com. So thanks for all the support and everybody being so supportive over this particular amount of time, especially with me just now getting back into the groove of things. It has been a big help and a big bolster to my health to know that everybody's been supportive of me and been patient with me having to be out so much. So I do appreciate that. Thank you so much. And hopefully I'll be able to give you some updates on my condition here in the next week when I know something. So I will let you know about that. Now, this particular proposal that the Trump administration has put forward on Snap, liberals have absolutely lost their minds when it came to this, because, like I said, there seems to be nothing but benefits, at least at first glance. It cuts down on cost, it cuts down on fraud, and it gets hungry people food in a more efficient way. I mean, to me, and maybe this is just me, but I despise going to the grocery store. So if someone offered to deliver at least half my groceries for the month directly to my door, I don't know about you, but I would be all over that. Anything that would cut down on my time at the grocery store would be something that would be helpful to me. But it seems as though there are no downsides to this particular proposal. But of course, people who, I think that a lot of them are doing this specifically because they just cannot stand the president and will oppose him on just about anything. Now, I'm not Obama's biggest fan either. There's a lot of the things that he's done and proposed that I don't necessarily care for. I've been very vocal about that on this program. However, I try to be as fair as possible and take things on a case-by-case basis, and this sounds like a really good proposal. So the people on the left have absolutely driven themselves crazy. The Huffington Post, this was a quote about this particular program. They said that facing a $1 trillion deficit because of his just passed tax cuts, President Donald Trump has an idea for how to get some of that money back, making poor people eat beans and rice. Okay. What's wrong with beans and rice? It fills your stomach. I mean, it's not as though it's hardtack and gruel or anything like that. I don't get the problem here. Yes, he's, you know, proposing that we save money by sending hungry people food. It still accomplishes the purpose of the SNAP program, so I don't get what the problem is here. Joe Berg, the CEO of Hunger Free America, SNAP is efficient because it is a free market model. Then he goes on to explain how this would not be a free market model. So here's my question. Because he's asserting that the way it works now is a free market model. Can anyone, and call in if you have an answer to this, because I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. Can anyone explain to me what is free market about the government taxing citizen A and then putting that money on a card and sending that card to citizen B to spend on his food? Please explain to me what about that scenario is free market. Anybody? No? See, if you think through this argument for more than 10 consecutive seconds, it completely falls apart. The SNAP is not a free market model because they do not earn that which they spend. And if there's one thing that is true about human nature, be it a child that receives allowance or an adult that lives off of government assistance, no one is as careful with someone else's money as they are with their own money. That's just a common... I was the same way. When I was getting money or spending money on a trip or something like that when I was in high school, that I didn't have a job and so my parents would pay for something for me. Back before I had a job, I think I got my first job when I just turned 17 the first time I had one. But back when I didn't have a job and my parents paid for everything, I was far less careful with money. Because once you start working for that which you have, you don't think of it as $8, you think of it as an hour of work. And like, well, I could buy this really expensive thing, but it's going to take me 2 or 3 days just to work enough to pay that off. It changes the way you think about things. And the same thing with EBT. Part of the reason that there's so much spending on EBT is because people are not as cautious with money that isn't theirs. So if you're standing there and you're having to choose between buying hamburger meat and buying a ribeye, well, if you have an EBT, what's the difference? You worked exactly the same amount of time for the ribeye as you did for the hamburger meat, which is nothing. Now, in my case, sometimes I had to buy the hamburger meat. Sometimes I had to buy the ground pork because it's even cheaper. There was even one week where I had Pop-Tart week. Y'all ever had Pop-Tart week? I knew a couple other college students that had had a Pop-Tart week. That's where you're out of money and you go to the grocery store and you buy about 4 or 5 boxes of Pop-Tarts and that's all you have for the week. I mean, it's uncomfortable. You can buy different flavors. That helps. It's not the best, but you do what you got to do. When you're out of money, you're just out of money. But when you're on government assistance, you're not nearly as cautious with that money. And so if you get that amount of money and you worked the same amount for the ribeye as you did for the hamburger, which is nothing, why not go for the ribeye? I certainly would. And that's another case of why sending people food items prepackaged is a better idea, because there is absolutely nothing free market about getting money from another citizen that the government took from them to feed yourself. Now, we can argue whether or not that program should be in place, that there should be that safety net there to help people. You know, we can argue back and forth on that. But what you cannot argue, what there's really not a case, there's no evidence to back up, is that a person will be just as responsible with government assistance as they will be with their own funds. That goes against human nature. Furthermore, he also said, this is Joe Berg again, Trump's proposal is far more intrusive, big government answer. They think that a bureaucrat in D.C. is better at picking out what your family needs than you are. Now, granted, I'll give him this one. That is not a bad argument, at least on its surface. Because it's so funny, we're actually seeing liberals, when they're looking at this, embrace the argument that a bureaucrat shouldn't be making these decisions. For one, it shows the superiority of the conservative argument, which is bureaucrats cannot make decisions better than you can. But here's the thing. When you're receiving something, you forfeit the right to make that decision. The example that I just gave earlier about panhandlers, If they ask me for food because they claim that they're hungry, and I say, okay, let's run down to Burger King and get us something to eat, and I've done that before and actually sat there and ate with them, got to know them, that kind of thing. You know, sometimes meet some really interesting people that way. But I would not take it from one of them to say, no, I want to go to Longhorn. Well, I'm sorry, you don't get to make that decision. When you're not making the decisions, you don't get to make the decisions when you're not the one footing the bill. And so I'm 100% behind the argument of bureaucrats in D.C. shouldn't be making decisions for my nutrition that I pay for myself. However, you're forfeiting your right to make some of those choices when you're not the one paying the bill. Because if I'm the one paying the bill and you're the one paying the bill as the taxpayer, then yes, they do get a say in it. This is one of the things that, again, don't want to get off on this tangent too far, but this is one of the things that irks me about the contraceptive argument. They'll say, well, when we were talking about Obamacare and the employers having to provide contraceptives for their employees, and liberals were crowing about this and saying, well, employers ought not to be able to say, we're going to buy this contraceptive or that contraceptive or not buy contraceptives at all in the case of, for example, Catholic-owned businesses. And so what your argument is essentially saying is that we want you to pay for it. We just don't want you to have any say in what the product actually is that you're buying. Well, I'm sorry. You're forfeiting that when you're opting to get something from someone else. Beggars can't be choosers. All right, we'll go through a couple more of these real quickly. Douglas Greenway, the president of the National WIC Association. Removing choice from SNAP flies in the face of encouraging personal responsibility. Again, what part of spending someone else's money does encourage personal responsibility? Seriously. What part of getting money that you got for free from somebody else and spending it on products to provide for you or your family. Again, whether or not you agree with the merits of the actual program itself and whether or not we should have it, that's a different argument. The question is, how does that teach personal responsibility in any way? All right, let's go on. Jim Wheel, the president of the nonprofit Food Research and Action Center, said, among the problems, it's going to be costly and take money out of the SNAP program from the administrative side. It's going to stigmatize people when they have to go from certain places, go to certain places to pick up benefits. Good. If that stigmatizes people, if they're embarrassed by having to go somewhere and pick up the goods, I don't know how that'll work. They haven't said whether it'll be delivered or whether you'll go to some kind of center to pick it up. I think it would probably be delivered, but let's just say for the sake of argument that what he's saying is true, that you do have to drive down to a distribution facility of some kind, pick up your harvest box. Well, first of all, I would think the only people that would be at that distribution center would be other people getting the harvest box. So I don't see how that would be embarrassing in the first place. But even if it was, so? Like I said just the other day when we were talking about education, embarrassment is a very powerful motivating factor. I'm not saying you go out of your way to embarrass people, but if people are embarrassed that they have to go and pick up food, well, then why don't they just get a job and they can buy their own food? I'm sorry, but I don't buy this idea that because it might stigmatize people, even though it's going to save money, cut down on fraud, all these things, that should be the primary factor that makes the decision. I'm sorry, I'm not willing to waste and lose taxpayer money because some people might get their precious little feelings hurt. I mean, they're not getting less in benefits, they're getting the same amount. And if that means that they have to drive or find a ride or take a bus or whatever to a distribution center, I'm sorry, that's what you got to do to get the assistance. Again, you're getting it for free, I wouldn't be complaining too much. So we've got a couple callers on the line, and we will get to them as soon as this commercial is over. There is a line open. If you want to grab it now. 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21, for to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back in. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And NewsRadio1440.com. Got a couple callers on the line, so we're going to go to them. We've got Donald Jenkins on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind this morning, Donald?
Oh, a very interesting subject you have there. And I think it brings up, and what the president has forced is a conversation that we have about a program that has been misused, as he says, bigly. And I think
right.
Part of the problem is what we call food. There are items that people buy with food stamps that I don't call sodas food. I mean, it's called a food product, but it has zero nutritional value.
Right.
So if you look at, and that's one of the biggest problems I see in the abuse, is people don't use them properly for nutrition. There are too many processed foods. There are too many canned goods that have no nutritional value, and there are too many items. You can buy candy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not really a food item to me. I call it something that's just junk food. So that's the main problem in there. So what you have, if you take 50% of a person's ability to receive it, and for whatever reason they're receiving it, let's assume that the majority of the people don't have employment for whatever reason, and they really need assistance. There are a lot of elderly people. There are a lot of disabled people. That's who I'm mainly concerned with. The other people, we need to tweak it a little bit so many people wouldn't be having it and abusing it.
Right, okay, and that's probably...
That's one thing we need to address, but that doesn't address that problem.
Right, who is receiving is not a part of this particular discussion. Now, that's a different
right.
discussion and a good one to have.
Yeah, that's
but not,
a different discussion.
But not for this
so
one.
So let's say in the people who receive it, here's going to be a problem. And when you say it's mm-hmm. a cost saving, is it really a cost saving? Because now we're talking about distributing a product. A huge amount of product, and according to what I've read, they're talking about the government buying it wholesale and having like a wholesale warehouse and distribute it from there. Okay, let's say it's Walmart. I'm just saying, Walmart has distributing divisional distributors throughout the nation, right?
Right, one of the biggest distributors in the country.
Very expensive. But so they work for a profit, so they buy food cheaper somewhere else so that they can put it in these huge warehouses and sell it here. That's how they can do that. That's free market.
Right, and that's also the reason that they can typically offer their products at very low prices is because they buy things in masses of bulk and then distribute them throughout the country. So
that's right, and they buy it from outside of a lot of it outside of the country.
Yes, they do.
So one of the things that was said in here that the food would come from inside of the country, which will automatically a lot of it will be higher than let's say Walmart, and then
depending on the product, but yes.
Then you have distributing facilities.
Mm.
Where will they be? So now you've created another bureaucracy where you have a distributing facility and this divisions throughout the United States of America. And no matter what state you're in, there are going to be counties that are going to be a long way from the distributing factor. So how would you get that to these individual and rural areas? So
well, now here would be my proposal to that problem. And I mean, you're bringing up a legitimate issue that people are going to have to think about with this. But what I would do, Donald, and I'm sorry, but I've got another caller, so I do have to go to him. But what my response would be to that is the United States government already owns a very sophisticated and long-reaching infrastructure organization. It's known as the United States Postal Service. And so my recommendation there, and they would probably have to either build on a new facility to some of the post offices or so forth, but the point is the Fed already has infrastructure in place that could assist them in doing that. And it is in every single community. And so that would be my response to solving that problem. Let's go to John from Millbrook online too. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, one of the points about this that you have already brought up is the part about embarrassment. You've covered it already, and rightfully so. And one of the arguments that I heard on the Progress Network is that the food wouldn't be healthy. And then as Donald said, he took part of what I was going to say, because on the list here on the website, as far as foods that are acceptable and can be bought, soft drinks, candy, cookies, snacks, crackers, ice cream, cakes, they can buy, which this part is good food, but it isn't spending the money wisely. Steak, seafood, bakery cakes are all eligible for the program. Now, obviously, tobacco products and household items and things like that are not available, and rightfully so. You have to consider, and also one of the things about this is an administrative cost. According to this is their site, you know, it costs $4.3 billion in staff costs for the EBT program.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that doesn't feed anybody. I mean, I know you've got to distribute.
That's overhead. They've got it. Yeah. They're probably spending too much on it like governments tend to do, but that's one of the things that you're running into. But here's would be my response to that, because I've heard that argument too, that it would be food that's not nutritional and it'll be kind of bland. The idea that not only should the federal government be taking money from one citizen to give to another citizen, and now they're adding on, and not only should they be giving money to that citizen, but they should be buying food on their terms, that I'm not going to get behind. Like, if you want food that's not bland, if you want food that is luxury, that's fine. Get a job, buy it yourself. And then you can buy whatever you want. I promise I won't complain about it.
Here's one thing that was interesting that I did like about it. I don't know what your response would be to it, but they can buy seeds to grow food with an EBT card.
Now, that is something that I did not know. I doubt many people utilize that. That would be that is something that I actually do appreciate about the program. I'll hand them that. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Here's the thing. A lot of these arguments are centered around we don't want to make the poor uncomfortable in any way. But Ben Franklin once said that you have to lovingly sometimes make the poor uncomfortable in their poverty so that they will do for themselves. Do it compassionately, but sometimes that has to be done. Hour 2 coming.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The Robert Porter controversy rages on, but will General John Kelly, will this be the nail in his coffin? We go there now on Tactics. Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. During the break, I had Joe Hunk from The Fallout call me, and he just pointed out that it was funny that we were having a discussion on the SNAP program with the EBT cards, and that one of the commercials that was running during the pre-recorded time was actually saying that EBT cards are welcome. So... It was ironic that we were having that discussion when that commercial happened to run, because we don't usually run that one. But nonetheless, it is good to be with you. It is Friday. Weekend is coming, and I know that a lot of you are excited about that. I certainly am. It's been a long week, been a long news week. And so I certainly am hoping that you and your family have a great weekend. But before we get there, there are important things to talk about. Robert Porter. For those of you who don't know, just a quick update or just a quick rundown of the story. Robert Porter is the guy in the Trump administration that was an aide. He was basically about third or fourth in command. He was somebody that worked closely with the chief of staff, General John Kelly. And he was someone that had a history of domestic abuse, or at the very least domestic abuse allegations. And we always want to be, well, I'll get into that in a second. So for right now, suffice it to say, all you really need to know to understand the background of the story is that Robert Porter has two ex-wives and a girlfriend that are all accusing him of domestic abuse. And one even has a picture of herself with a black eye that she claims that was given to her when Robert Porter hit her. However, Robert Porter was somebody that was apparently very good at his job, somebody that was very efficient and helpful in the White House. And because of that, people are wondering if General John Kelly, Trump's chief of staff, knew about it, when he knew about it, and was he defending Porter despite knowing that he was someone accused of domestic abuse. And looking at the Porter case, the evidence looks pretty bad. We've hashed out cases like this before on this program. I've told you the flaws and the evidence that supports things like the Roy Moore scandal, Al Franken, so on and so forth. The evidence in this one looks pretty convincing. And there's not just the picture of his ex-wife with the black eye, but the stories have been fairly consistent across each of the timelines. Between each of the women presenting this and the timeline that they have presented. And so because of that, it does give their story some credence in the fact that they have talked about that before now. Now, it became a big media thing over the past week, but really this accusation and this string of accusations really have been going on for quite some time. In fact, when he first got into the White House, he was denied security clearance because he had a record of people accusing him of domestic abuse. And so he didn't have permanent security clearance because of that. And so it is very hard to make the case that the White House had no indication whatsoever of what was going on here. Either they didn't know the extent of it and didn't bother looking into it, or they just knew about it and let everything go and brought him in anyway. Now, I think it's probably somewhere closer to the middle, to where they probably had an idea about it, but they didn't look too far into it. And I understand that to an extent. And here's what I mean by that. When you hire a person, be it government or private company, you don't necessarily make it your mission to delve into every aspect of their personal life. And so there may be things, even if they're horrific, like a domestic abuse, that you have no indication about and don't know about. However, in this case, where he was specifically denied security clearance because of his history of having women accuse him of abusing them, that should have raised some red flags, and there should have been some people in the White House, especially in this White House where the media is clawing at their door every single day, that somebody should have said, hold on a second, we may want to reconsider this. And so just from a wisdom standpoint, it was unwise to not look further into this guy's records. Now, Trump is saying that he is denying it. Robert Porter is denying it. And we have due process. Now, especially in the light of the Me Too movement, I am all for talking about due process. If someone is actually accused of something, then we need to hash it out, let the court system decide. I agree with that. However, Trump is using this basically as an excuse to not comment on the facts of the case. I've been promoting due process since this whole movement began, but I've also never used it as an excuse to not talk about what's going on and what I think is probably happening. And in Robert Porter's case, the evidence, at least the evidence that we have so far, it basically points to one conclusion. And the only evidence that would be against him being a domestic abuser are his words. Any of the physical evidence we have points in the other direction. And so that being said, I'm not saying that the president should have out and out said, oh, he's absolutely guilty and they need to prosecute him or anything like that, because I don't think that that would have been the best way to go either. But the president can come out and say, look, it looks bad for Robert Porter. He seems to me to be a very sick man, somebody that needs help, and we hope that he gets the help that he needs and can move past this. That would have been a much better response than the one he gave, where basically, well, he says he's innocent, therefore he's innocent. Or he says he's innocent, therefore we're going to ignore it. A claim of innocence is not the same as actually being innocent. And that's not what due process means. Due process means we don't know for sure, we're going to sort it out. And we're going to look at the evidence available to us. I believe what Donald Trump is doing, and were I advising the president, I would advise against this strongly, is he doesn't want to talk about it, therefore he's saying, due process, let's move on. Now, does this need to be the most important story in the country and need to be on the media's, on the tip of everybody's tongue for months to come? No, I don't think so. But it is important to ask whether or not the White House is at all concerned about this. Now, the left cares about this because they want to extend the accusations to Trump. See, the reason that the left is so gung-ho about talking about this story is because what they're trying to do is trap Trump in a moment with the press, for example, where he has to say, well, yes, it looks like Robert Porter has done what he's done, therefore we needed to get rid of him and he needs to resign. And what the press wants to do with that is they want to respond with, well, women have accused you of such and such, therefore should you resign? And there's a couple reasons why that argument doesn't work, and there's a couple ways around that argument. First of all, as much as I dislike Trump, as much as I dislike Trump personally, I'll say it that way, as much as I don't care for his character, as much as I have talked about both during the election and after the election, the fact that he is a deeply flawed character, especially when it comes to sexual conduct around other women, at least that's what he has done in the past. The difference in him and Robert Porter is this was apparently discovered about Porter after he was already in his position. Trump was elected, everybody knowing that that's the kind of person that he was. Now, in my opinion, he shouldn't have been elected, everybody knowing that that's the kind of person that he was. But the fact is that he was. It was not as though we had this new revelation that came out after Trump took the White House. And furthermore, Trump's response to this can be, well, I don't know about Robert Porter. I wasn't there when those incidents happened, but I was there when the incidents I'm being accused of happened, and I'm telling you they didn't happen. Is that a strong defense? Not really. But it is a way that the president could say, well, it doesn't look like this guy needs to be here anymore, but I'm going to be. Not a strong defense, but a defense. So I don't think that the president has to necessarily stand behind Porter in order to keep his own job. Weirdly enough, with Donald Trump, it seems like the guy is so Teflon that absolutely nothing sticks to him. And so even when I think things should affect his presidency, they seem not to somehow. So I don't think that that's necessarily the way it's going to be. Now, how will it affect General Kelly? It does look like he knew, or at least ought to have known. If he doesn't know or didn't know, then he should have known because he needed to keep a closer eye on his staff. And so what we have at the very least here is Kelly not keeping a closer eye on who he works with. Now, that doesn't mean that General Kelly needs to be the domestic police. And what I mean by that is you don't have to delve into every little aspect of your staff's private life. But something that was that big, that had been going on for that long, and that there's that much evidence against him, John Kelly should have seen a red flag at some point. And I don't think it's unreasonable for people to make that assertion, especially considering he had to, for security reasons, he couldn't even get his security clearance. Robert Porter couldn't, because of his history of domestic abuse. And so that should have shot up a red flag, and somebody in Kelly's staff should have said, hey, we need to take another look at this guy. Now, if Kelly did know this, honestly, I'm disappointed in him for not nipping this in the bud and doing it sooner. But here would be my response to the people on the left that are just salivating at the idea to get rid of John Kelly. Do you really want Kelly gone? Seriously, think about that. John Kelly is one of the most stabilizing forces in the Trump White House. The general has come in. Donald Trump's tweeting is nearly as erratic. There's not, like it was under Rice Priebus, there's not people just coming and going and anybody can walk into the president's office and have his ear, which is a good thing. John Kelly's actually much more selective about that, about who has the president's ear. And so he's a very stabilizing force within the White House. And so my question in response to you is, for all of you on the left that just can't stand Donald Trump, that don't like him, that don't like his style, don't like how he flies off the handle, do you really want to get rid of the person that probably stabilizes that White House the most? Think about that. I'm so tired of people on both sides playing games with this story, because it degrades Porter's ex-wives as well as the other victims of domestic abuse, that there are some people that probably are legitimately concerned about his ex-wives, but it seems to me that, especially in Washington, the vast majority of the people that are talking about this are doing so because they believe it furthers their own political careers. That for those that will defend Trump on absolutely anything, they're going to defend him because they don't want to hurt the Trump agenda. And for the people that are on the other side of it that hate Trump and want to stand against absolutely everything he does, regardless of what the policy is, they're just doing it because in their own mind, they're hurting Trump in some way. Let's not play games with this. Let's actually look at the case, look at the facts, look at what we've discovered, and make a decision based on that. 860-1440 are the numbers. We'll be back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and News Radio 1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Speaking of, we had a couple callers on the line, but unfortunately they dropped as soon as I went to a commercial. So I do apologize for that. I don't have a call screener, so it's a little hard for me to get to the phones right away. I'm having to answer phones and do a show at the same time. But we'll try to get to you if you do want to call in. There's a couple lines open, 860-1440, if you do want to call in. Or you can tweet us, as always, at Tactics Radio if you happen to be one who is want to tweet, as it were. It's a quick way to get in touch with us. I did want to mention this other story, too. This happened this week. A federal judge has ruled that the Trump administration cannot end DACA. This is a New York judge who has said that it would not be possible for the president to end the DACA program, and that the president and his administration is going to have to continue registering Dreamers under that program. There's a couple problems with this. First of all, I don't really understand how the judge can order someone to continue a program that was set to expire. So essentially what Trump would be doing is he has given a time limit on this before he undoes the DACA executive order. But here's the thing. DACA was enacted by one person, Barack Obama. And it was essentially, and this is why it was unconstitutional, it was not a new law, but it functioned like a law. The executive has absolutely no power whatsoever to write laws. And furthermore, it has no power granted to it by the Constitution to affect immigration and naturalization anyway. Like other laws, the executive branch has the power to enforce such laws, but it cannot make them or change policy. And what the DACA order said was it was essentially an order to not deport these particular kinds of people, which cannot be done. You cannot just say, well, I don't like this law, so despite the fact that I took an oath to uphold the Constitution and I can't write law under the Constitution, I'm going to effectively write law anyway. I'm sorry, you can't do that. That's not how it works. And so, because it was originally put into place by executive order, it can be taken away just as easy. That's why it is important to, and I've said this about people on the right who get excited about some of Donald Trump's executive orders, keep in mind, it's just an executive order. And when the next person comes in, they can undo it just as easily. If you want something to actually become a law and be permanent, that is supposed to be done through Congress. And part of the problem and the reason that I believe we're in a constitutional crisis right now is because, regardless of whether your guy is in office or not, one of the big problems that we have, and granted, Donald Trump has been far better on this than Barack Obama was. He's not abused the executive order nearly to the extent that Obama has. There's been one or two that I've disagreed with, but by and large, his executive orders have been primarily things that executive orders are supposed to be. Saying to an administration, hey, let's look into this, or could you bring me this information, please? Things like that. Whereas Barack Obama's were trying to be executive fiat laws, many of them, not all of them, but a lot of them. Essentially saying, well, I don't like this law, so you're not supposed to enforce this one. I do like this law, so you need to enforce this one. That's essentially what this whole controversy with Jeff Sessions was started. Now, keep in mind, I am someone who disagrees with there even being federal laws on the books for any substances. Not because I think that all those substances should be legal, but I think that if we are to make them illegal, they should be handled at the state level, because the Constitution grants no authority to the federal government to regulate those substances. Therefore, I have often made the case that if we're going to have laws that outlaw things like marijuana, they don't need to be at the federal level. However, what Jeff Sessions was doing with essentially rolling back the policy that his predecessor had, which was to not enforce drug laws, or at least not enforce them on states that said, okay, we're going to make it legal, that was what Jeff Sessions was supposed to do. We need to get that law either declared unconstitutional by the courts, or we need to have Congress take that law off the books. I would prefer the congressional route. But another thing, too, that's part of the problem that we're having as a whole with our federal government, is that we're having very little success getting anything through Congress. So Congress, the only branch of government that is supposed to legislate, is not legislating, which, again, I don't necessarily have a huge problem with. Because even though there's some things that I would really like to get through Congress, the less Congress does, the better in many cases. However, you've got the executive branch and the judicial branch both legislating who are not supposed to, effectively writing their own laws, because you've got justices like this one who interpret the law as they wish it to be rather than what it actually says. And then you've also got an executive that has amassed too much power over the years. So DACA was already an unconstitutional breach of the separation of powers to begin with. It was already a decision that said, I'm going to bypass the legislative process and rule by executive fiat. And if you don't believe me, look at the timeline for when DACA took place. Let us remember what DACA actually is. It's essentially the president saying that I don't like this law, ergo I will not enforce it. What would happen to a sheriff that did that? Let's say we elected a sheriff, and the sheriff said, yeah, I don't like those speeding laws, we're not enforcing those. Well, that sheriff would not be doing his job. He doesn't get to decide what the laws are. His job is to uphold the law. He doesn't get to unilaterally just decide, I don't like that law, I'm not gonna pester people that are engaged in it. That is not his role. And furthermore, when looking back at the timeline of how DACA came into place, remember that Barack Obama himself actually said that if Congress doesn't act on this, I will. So he put forward the idea of the DREAM Act, tried to get it through Congress. It didn't go anywhere. It went nowhere very quickly. And because it went nowhere, he says, well, Congress hasn't acted, therefore I'm going to act. Well, that's not how the presidency works. You as the president don't get to just say, Congress isn't doing what I like, therefore I'm going to do it on my own. Or if Congress doesn't make a decision on this, then I'm going to. That's nowhere in the Constitution. If Congress's decision is to not do anything on it, then nothing gets done on it. That's the constitutional model. There is no clause in the Constitution that says because the president is unhappy with the way that the Congress works, he is granted extra power to make laws. I'm sorry, but that's not the way our Constitution was set up, and that's not the way that it should work. One person should not be unilaterally able to make laws. That's the reason we have a representative republic. So we've already got this judge that is saying that even though this DACA executive order was administered by the president, it cannot be undone by the president? That makes no sense. It was already an unconstitutional breach of power anyway. And so now his ruling is, but you can't undo it. Again, this is just one more example of a judge that does not like the way something is going, and so he interprets and rules on his legal opinion. He gives his legal opinion and states the law as he wishes it to be, not how it actually is. And that's not a judge's job either. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Governments could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source, from the King of Kings and the Lord of all the earth, General John Dickinson, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. And you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio if you want to get in that way. We were talking the last segment about this DACA bill and this federal judge that is saying now that you cannot end DACA. The president can't just undo the executive order that the last president did, even though that's exactly what an executive order is. That's the reason that it's not binding usually, and the reason that it should not affect current law is because an executive order, Obama was using it against its intended purpose, and because of that, now the judge is saying that it must continue to do so. But here's the thing. You know who else thinks that DACA is unconstitutional? Because it's not just me. I'm not the only one that thinks it's unconstitutional. You know who else believes that? Barack Obama. Now, I know some of you are going to sit there and scratch your heads, but I'm being completely 100% honest with you. It's not a trick. Barack Obama believes that DACA is completely unconstitutional. And if you don't believe me, here's a quote from Obama back in 2010 when he was asked about doing something for the Dreamers. He said, "I am not a king. I can't do these things just by myself." They asked him why he didn't do something about it, and that was his response. March 2011. He said, "With respect to the notion that I can just suspend deportations through executive order, that's just not the case." So him admitting that it is not within the power of the president to just suspend deportations. May 2011, he acknowledged that he couldn't, quote, "just bypass Congress and change the immigration law myself. That's not how democracy works." I take issue with him calling us a democracy, but that's a discussion for another day. Nonetheless, three occasions before he signed DACA into executive order, that Barack Obama himself said, "I can't do that. It's unconstitutional." And eventually he just said, "Well, doesn't matter whether it's constitutional or not, I'm doing it." Which, honestly, at this point, it's hard to blame him, because he had packed the court with so many liberal justices that, again, like I said, interpret the law as they think it ought to be rather than what the law actually says, that so far, they have not stayed his hand on that. This is one more example of how broken our courts are now. Judges have seen themselves as activists that want to make the law say what they believe it ought to say rather than interpreting it on its merits in the way that it is. And if you want another example of this, a federal appeals court has said that Trump's tweets are now the reason that his Muslim ban cannot stay in place. This was really fascinating. And so far, this has been the justification for all of the decisions on Trump's travel bans that have tried to put a hold on it. So he's had a third travel ban in place now. According to the judge, the words of this president provided an undisputed evidence of anti-Muslim bias. That's according to the judge that wrote the majority opinion in this ruling. In a 9-4 ruling in the federal appeals court held this version of Trump's travel ban, which were limiting specifically visitors from terror-torn countries, countries that have a problem and a history of terrorism. And that was, of course, the reason that he said these specific countries were not going to be taking any more people from, at least for a little while, until we get some kind of handle on what's going through. But every single ruling that has dealt with the travel ban has gone back to, well, it's because Trump tweets out nasty things about Muslims. Look, whether or not you believe the guy is actually anti-Muslim should be immaterial to this. And here's why. When you are looking at the law and interpreting the law, you are supposed to judge the law based on its actual words, based on the merits of what the law actually says. Regardless of what the intent was, you cannot just look at law and say, well, we think that there might have been ill intent behind it. Let's take the absolute worst case scenario, and I'm talking a ridiculous extreme here. Let's say there was somebody who is an actual Nazi, a raging anti-Semite, that took the executive office and passed a law dealing with travel just like this, and it banned certain countries from that. And the judge came back and said, well, because this guy is an anti-Semite, we can't invoke that because it might affect some Jews. Well, that doesn't affect the constitutionality of the law itself. Even if Trump is this horrible, hateful, which I don't believe that he is, but even if you believe Trump to be this horrible, hateful, anti-Muslim bigot, that does not affect the fact that his executive orders do not mention Muslims. Because if that's the standard that you are going to put together, then you could say that anything that he signs into law, well, his motivation might not have. It doesn't matter what his motivation is. It matters what the law says. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the reason that he is blocking those specific countries, which, by the way, that is a list that was put together by the Obama administration of high-risk countries, when it came to terrorist activity, not one that he and his staff put together, but regardless, take that off the table for just a moment. Even if his motivation was to keep more Muslims out of the country, that doesn't matter. What matters is what the law actually says. If the law is saying that it is because there is a high risk of terrorism and it can be corroborated through unbiased sources, and there is clearly a problem and a national security risk with letting people from those countries into our country, then his motivation is irrelevant. If it had banned specifically Muslims, yeah, I 100% agree with you. That should be struck down. But that's not what the law says. And so this is a problem that we're running into. We have gotten into the age of activist justices that when they look at a law, they judge the law based on the conclusion they want to get to. They don't have an open mind and interpret the law based on what is before them. They've got a conclusion. They just have to figure out how to get to that conclusion legally. And that's not the way a judge is supposed to work. A judge is supposed to the best of his ability, and I know that we're all humans and we are the product of our lives, the product of our life experiences, and so we have inherent bias. I understand that. That's an unfortunate side effect of being a human being. However, the judge is supposed to the best of his ability, come into it completely objective, taking the information based solely on the actual letter of the law, and then make a decision based upon that. You cannot just make decisions based on other factors that might be surrounding the person that was making the law. You're supposed to judge it based on the law itself, not the person who wrote it. Because if that were the case, for example, let's say that I was a justice. That's a terrifying thought. But let's say I was actually interpreting law. I would not be able to say, well, that Woodrow Wilson guy was an evil, hateful racist, so anything that happened during his administration, that is now null and void. That's not how the law works. I may dislike the guy. I may disagree with his politics. But I have to judge each law on a case-by-case basis and make a decision based on that. I don't get to just, because I disliked the guy or disliked some of the things that he said, get to say, as a justice, well, I don't like the guy, therefore his laws don't matter. We need to get back to a place where judges and citizens alike care about the Constitution, are knowledgeable about the Constitution, and their first loyalty is to the rule of law, not their own personal preferences. Chaplin's Report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back, everybody. It is time for the Chaplain's Report. And for those of you who have not known about this, and by the way, one of the things that I talked about with my new podcast is every day I post my Chaplain's Report, so if you need just a quick 5 to 10 minute little devotional every day, I've got you covered on that. It's on my Twitter feed, on my Tactics Facebook page, so you can check those out there. Be sure to share them, send them to people. You know, you may not want to get political, and in this day and age, even though that's obviously my bread and butter, I understand that, but these are not political and have no political bias. I just talk about the Bible. And there's one particular Bible story in Matthew 27:45-47. That we're going to talk about today, because I've been doing this series on the things that Jesus said on the cross. And he only said 7 things on the cross. We don't have a lot of record of what was actually going on in the crucifixion. In all of the Gospels, we only have about a chapter's worth of information on what was going on during the crucifixion. And so this is one of the 7 things that Jesus said while on the cross, Matthew 27:45-47. Now from the 6th hour, darkness fell upon the land until the 9th hour. And about the 9th hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of those who were standing there were heard it and began saying, this man is calling for Elijah. So here we have Jesus calling out in an hour of great desperation, asking God why he has been forsaken. It's easy for us to feel like God has forsaken us sometimes. Sometimes we get to a particularly dark place or into a situation that we know is going to end badly, and we just feel like there's no way out. We feel trapped. And because of that, it feels as though we have been abandoned by God. But the truth is, God never abandons us. God is always with us. But this situation was different. In all three of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this quote is found. And in all three, it is mentioned directly after the sky goes dark. You see, what happened here is that Jesus, at this point on the cross, took on the sin of mankind. All of it. From the beginning, from Eve and Adam partaking of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, to whatever will be the last sin committed before Judgment Day. All the sins of man, everyone that has ever lived, Christ took on all of their sins at once. And because of that, Jesus was in a place to where God could no longer be with him the way that he had been. Because he had taken on sin, and a holy, just God cannot have association with sin. And so he momentarily turned his back on his son. And look at the repercussions. The sky went dark. It was as though the world was ending. Because God had to turn away when Jesus took on the sin of mankind. When God had to turn away, the world felt the results. You see, sin creates this distance between us and God. We know from other scriptures that the wages of sin are death, that the consequence for sin in the Garden of Eden was that death was going to come to Adam and Eve. And isn't it interesting that this is something that gets lost in translation? The Hebrew word for death is the same word as the Hebrew word for separation. See, death and separation are the same thing in Hebrew. And the death, according to the scripture, is the separation of soul from body. So what took place is when Jesus took on the sin of the world, he felt a distance between him and God, a separation between him and God. And for someone that was his only begotten son, that had existed in God's presence his entire life, that was incredibly foreign to him. He didn't know what it was like to feel that kind of distance between him and God. And when you have fellowship with God like he did, the stronger fellowship you have, the closer you are with God, the more you feel your sin distancing yourself from him. We can see language like this that was found in David's writings in the Psalms after he committed his sin with Bathsheba, that he felt as though he was no longer in God's presence, that he didn't have that kinship with God that he once had. Sin drives us away from God. That's why it has to be forgiven. That's why it has to be removed, so that we can have fellowship with him again. And because Jesus had been in God's presence and had never felt that before, he now felt that separation more than any other man. That's what our Savior did for us. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.